Apparently, there are three alien races that have visited the Earth and continue to visit the Earth.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Can I guess which?
Sure, please.
The Greys?
Yes.
Reptilians?
Yes.
And the blondes, the tall ones?
The Norse giants.
Yes.
Yes.
That's my alien... That's just irritating. But mine was a good
and
rendition of an alien flying saucer landing.
Welcome to Nerd Burger, episode 43. I'm Mike.
And I'm Craig.
How you doing, Craig?
I'm good. How are you?
Fine.
Mostly awake?
Mostly awake.
Caffeinated?
Oh, I'm caffeinated.
I'm finally awake. I think it took getting, like, sitting down here in front of the microphone to wake up. I spent the first 3 or 4 hours today just in a daze watching television.
All the severe thunderstorm warnings and tornado warnings didn't wake you up?
No. No, that doesn't. That stuff doesn't do anything. We've got a couple of guests here today, and one of them is running a little late, so we're going to dive into getting the first person on board first. First person on board first?
Firstly?
Firstly. Here he is. His name's Joey.
Hi, Joey.
Hello.
And he's somebody I met at Gen Con last year, because he was playtesting a board game that he's now kickstarting. And so we're gonna talk about that eventually, but we want to wait for the other guy to get here first. But how's it going out there? You're in the, over on the West Coast, Derry?
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful weather out here. It's like 70 degrees. I don't know what everyone's talking about on the other coast.
People like us hate people like you.
So the polar vortex missed you? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, it's gorgeous out here. It's gorgeous.
Every well, it's day always gorgeous.
Every day I wake up to sunshine. I spring from my bed screaming, Bazinga! It's just wonderful. I don't know what everyone's talking about.
Well, it's sunny every day because you're having a drought, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, we do live in a desert.
Yeah, down here in Atlanta, it can't stop raining, it seems like.
No.
I learned why it rains more on weekends, and it does.
Urban heat island effect?
Pollution and stuff, yeah. Okay. We have the industrialized societies have effectively a 7-day dust and particulate cycle, and it causes things to happen in the air. It does the science in the air, whatever that is.
The air does its own science?
Yes, okay. And then that makes it rain on Saturdays, and Saturdays get more rain than any other day of the week in industrialized nations.
And today's Saturday.
Correct.
And there are puddles and lakes and rivers in my yard.
Lock Brock. That big, dirty puddle.
When they built my house, they piled all of the construction debris into one spot in the front yard and then buried it. And slowly, over the years, it's decomposed and it's created this crater.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, that's what that is. And it fills with water when it rains.
Nice. Oh, but you don't have anything like that going on, Joey. Everything's wonderful and filled with puppy dogs and butterflies out there.
Yeah, I don't understand. People across the world know that Southern California exists. Why don't they just come here?
You want them all to come there?
Whoa, okay. Hey, world. Hey, all you fat a-hole Midwesterners and all you gun-toting Montana guys. Yeah, California invites you to come over there.
Well, I must say that whenever it rains here, people just stand awkwardly on the sidewalk, just staring up at the sky, and they're like, what's that? And there's so many traffic accidents, when it's just drizzling. Nobody knows how to drive out here when it rains.
Why is it showering on the outside?
This is supposed to happen in my bathroom.
Yeah. Well, that happens here, too, with any kind of weather.
Yeah.
Really, if it rains. If it's cold, if it's cloudy, and it doesn't stop people in their tracks when they're walking because everyone's in their car. So it stops them in their tracks in their car, and then we have traffic.
Yeah. As soon as there's a little bit of rain, it doesn't even have to be raining.
No, it could just be like
2 hours after the rain.
Everybody, it can be kind of like really high humidity that fogs up your windshield.
Everybody
just
drives
grinds
at 35.
To a halt.
Yeah. I hate people. God, I hate people. I like you, Mike. Joe, thanks. You seem like a good guy.
I'm a good guy, but I must admit I'm enjoying the sunshine.
All right, well, I've got a little bit of news.
News?
Hey, Mike.
Yes.
And maybe, Joey, you listened to this episode, but a while back, a couple times, we've talked about the slow demise of the old standard of network television.
Yeah.
Of a show being on once a week with a bunch of commercials. You can only watch it at one time. That's dying. That's going away.
Yep.
Well, somebody has paid attention because as of January 6th.
January.
What?
It's January.
Whatever. As of January 6th this year, ABC is offering all of their television shows online.
Wow.
Every single one. Now, there's a whole, you got to do it a certain way. You got to subscribe and you'll certainly deal with ads still, but you'll be able to watch the shows when you want to.
I believe I watch exactly one show on ABC. So, yay, Modern Family.
Mm-hmm. Not that you DVR everything anyway, so.
Yeah.
Now, I imagine, Joey, you haven't been watching a lot of television lately because you've been trying to get a board game made.
He's just been a little bit busy.
I used to watch Lost on ABC.
Joey, that's
all
been off
the
air for several years now.
I took that very seriously. I was proud at the time to have met a bunch of podcasters who were involved in the Lost community, and now when I try to explain to people what it was like every week to be talking to people online about that show, the people just don't get it. They just don't understand the sense of community that sprung up.
That's true.
So it would have been nice to
that
have Lost,
to an extent, yeah.
To have, I think at some point they started putting the episodes online so you could watch it, but the first two seasons, if you missed an episode, you were in trouble.
True. That show was on kind of right in the turn that we've taken toward video on demand, and everything's in DVD sets now. And I mean, that's how I did my Lost thing, is I always bought the DVD sets. And then I'd binge watch the first season before the second season started.
Yeah.
It's also one of those shows that I got so heavily into, and I dissected the hell out of that show and went to message boards, and me and Mike talked about it all the time. I have zero interest in watching it ever again. Like,
yeah.
I did that. I did like five times the work that I needed to do.
You burned out all your Lost receptors in your brain.
I went to Comic-Con in 2006, and it was like I had arrived at Babylon or something like that. And or Mecca, and everybody had like gone to Hall H, and we were ready for like answers. And I would say that was sort of it was right at the beginning or middle of season three, and it was sort of the beginning of what I consider to be the end. And I liked the second half of season three, but in my opinion, if you just kind of draw a guillotine down right after season three and just get rid of everything else after that and just tell people watch the first three seasons and then just don't worry about it, don't worry about the mysteries, don't worry, because you'll be more satisfied to not know than to know that they didn't know what they were doing.
Well, we've debated this on the podcast and face-to-face with Mike and friends of mine and everything. Your mileage will vary on all that. I like the show fine. I never got hung up on the mysteries. I figured I'll just get the answers that I get, and that'll be it. And I didn't get overly worried about it. So I actually enjoyed the whole run of the show.
So were you a shipper?
No, I'm not a shipper for any show. I don't give a crap about who falls in love with who. Relationshipper.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Mike's looking at me.
What the?
That's the people who get all hung up on, will they or won't they? Should Kate be with Jack or with Sawyer? Well, turns out Kate was with Charlie in real life.
Yeah.
And then you get, fan fiction and slash fiction and all this kind of stuff where it's like, should Michael get it on with Jin? Well, some watches.
Did you just make that up?
No, I'm sure I didn't. I'm sure there's somebody out there that wrote a whole short story about that and probably inserted themselves into the story as well. Yeah. So in keeping a little bit with, we're kind of getting into a little bit of an outer space theme today, and you'll see more of that in a little bit. I have this question for you. Listen to this.
This station is now the ultimate power in the universe. I suggest we use it.
Don't be too proud of this technological terror you've constructed. The ability to destroy a planet is insignificant next to the power of the Force.
Don't try to frighten us with your sorcerer's ways, Lord Vader. Your sad devotion to that ancient religion has not helped you conjure up the stolen data tapes, or given you clairvoyance enough to find the rebels' hidden fort.
And the choke. Yep. Force choke.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Blah de blah. And it goes from there. We all know what this is, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's Admiral Mahdi from Star Wars. One of the good ones. This was brought up on a radio program I listened to a little while back, and it got me really thinking, too. What the hell is wrong with this guy that he's smack-talking Darth Vader like that? Does he not know who Vader is? Vader's not been around running the show, you know, being the big tough guy for 30 years.
Did George Lucas write that?
No, but just it's one of those odd things where everybody else shows this reverence for Darth Vader, and Mahdi's got to get all up in his big black grill.
Yeah. Well, he's the only one without a British accent or an Australian accent, and so maybe he came from somewhere else where, you know, no one clued him in. Like, dude, stop.
You'd think that Darth Vader would have, at some point, in order to rise to power, demonstrate some sort of force abilities along the way.
Yeah, like the kind of this mystical sorcery of yours, and then he proceeds to sorcerer him right in the neck. People didn't know he could do that. Mahdi was, how stupid are you?
It's called dialogue-driven exposition, and this is what we create out here in Hollywood.
Hey, look at that, inside scoop. That's entirely what it is. It's to show, hey, Darth Vader's got superpowers. But they could have found a different way. This is all I'm saying. It just seemed like, really?
Like, I mean, they could have just cut the line and just had him do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, well, why didn't they have him have that conversation with Leia?
I don't know.
You know?
Well, she was, yeah.
Show what
she
happened
was,
then.
She was all
have him choke her a little bit.
She was all tough guy when she's talking to Vader earlier. Uh-huh. You know, she's right up in his face. That's true.
Yeah, he could choke her and then her robe could, like, partially come off.
Now you're talking.
Okay, Lucas, you remade these movies how many times? Couldn't throw a little? Well, that's okay, though. We get Leia in the slave bikini outfit later on anyway, so.
Yeah, but the slug is in the same shot. You know, this is the classic problem.
Sorry.
Oh, and then that has to be James Earl Jones' voice really low like that. Princess.
Totes my goats.
No, jeez. I hate those ads. Anyway.
That one's funny. I actually had to look that up to find out where that came from.
What else
you got?
That's a good question. I don't have a lot. We were kind of waiting on somebody here. Oh, here's one. Something I learned from QI. Joey, are you familiar with QI?
No, what's QI?
QI is
the opposite of IQ.
Yes, it's IQ reverse. It stands for quite interesting. It's a British quiz/panel show. Stephen Fry hosts it. He asks a bunch of questions. All the panelists are comedians. So it's like partly trivia and partly just comedy.
Yeah.
And you win points not so much for answering correctly, but for answering and giving the most interesting answers. But something that came up, I came across was, how many cards in a deck of playing cards? Standard deck.
52.
Okay, including jokers.
54.
54, right? How many combinations of unique card orders, unique shuffles, do you think there are?
Okay, so it would be 54 times 53 times 52, etc., all the way, right?
Right.
So 54 exclamation point, whatever that's called.
Well, the number is, it starts with an 8, it ends with a 0, it's 67 digits long. Now, none of us can really fathom how big that number. I have a hard time picturing 1,000 of something. But here's an explanation that I saw given about how big that number is. If every star in our galaxy had a trillion planets orbiting it, and every planet had a trillion people on it, and every person on every planet had a trillion decks of cards that they shuffled once, they shuffled 1,000 times every second. And they did
That's
this
fast.
And they did this since the Big Bang. We would only have recently hit that number of unique shuffles. If they got a unique shuffle on every shuffle, every one of those people, we would have only recently started to repeat card combinations. That's how big that number is.
That's a big number.
You heard it here. Two hosts agree. That's a big number. Which just kind of blew me away. And then somebody else on the message board where they were talking about this did the math or whatever and knew some more stuff about science and said, if you add 7 cards to that deck and figure out how big that number is, it's larger than the estimated number of cells in the known galaxy.
Cells.
Cells.
Living cells.
Yes. Or, well, let me see what was... Maybe I did that. Maybe I said that wrong. Where's the quote? Atoms.
We'll go with
atoms. Sorry, atoms.
Whoa!
That's the word I was looking for.
Whoa!
More than the number of estimated atoms in the known galaxy.
That's a big number.
That's an extra big number. So there, I share that with you. I've been watching QI a lot. How's the QI stuff coming, Mike?
I'll be watching QI a lot.
Okay.
In the near future.
Now, are they funnier on that show because they're British?
Well, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of British humor, and you know it has a British bent to it. But you know, it's sometimes they're just telling funny stories. Sometimes, I mean, and the people that are on there too, they have people on there who are just ridiculously knowledgeable about stuff. You wouldn't think it, but there's like, you know, there's one or two guys that'll bust off like the birth and death date of any pope. He just knows them. And Stephen Fry made a bit out of it at one point. He just started naming popes. And the guy started telling you when they were born and died and where. Like in what city, in what country. It was just like...
Yeah, that's a devout Catholic right there.
that's a devout
Church of Englander. But it was weird. But it's a fun show. And he's here, finally. We can bring somebody else on board. Hey, Ray, how'd the rain treat you coming over here?
Oh, there was only one accident.
Were you in it?
No, thank you.
Okay. I'm just checking. Because, I mean, if you get into an accident right near your driveway, that's all you saw was the one accident.
That's
might
true.
Have been the only one.
But he made it here.
But he I got did. Here.
I did, through massive atmospheric disturbances.
Oh, right. So I think now that we've got Ray here, Joey, we're going to unleash you. And we're going to talk about your board game, which is kickstarting right now. Let's talk Chaos Mouse. Take it away.
Take it away. All right. So what would you like to know?
What's,
you want to know about the game?
Yeah, what's the game about? Tell everybody. Tell all 9 of our listeners.
Chaos Mouse is a space-themed board game, and it's set in a collapsing universe. So you're going to assume the role of an alien on the hunt for a rare artifact that's going to save your race from doom when the universe collapses around you. So it's a 2-4 player, card-driven board game, and it features a bunch of innovative mechanics and a bunch of really unique, interesting aliens and miniatures.
And I'm looking at your Kickstarter page right now. You had a goal of $40,000, and I was looking at that when it first came up, and I thought, wow, that's a big goal. And little do I know how ridiculously popular your game is and how well you've marketed it and how well you've designed it and how well you've gotten people on board, because you guys topped that 40,000 less than a week?
Yes, 5 or 6 days.
Awesome.
Yeah, up to 50,000 and change right now.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thank
well,
you.
Well
it's,
done.
It's been a long road. Amazing, amazing experience. We started about a year ago.
Started a year with the game.
We had sort of the game a year ago, and then we decided to make a real game that would be published about a year ago. And it's taken all of our money and all the money that we can put onto our credit cards.
So that was kind of like one of my big questions. This is Ray, by the way. In producing your own board game, where did you come up with, like the demo that we played at Gen Con, you know, where did you come up with the pieces? Did you like hijack parts of other games? Did you just print a bunch of stuff off?
Yeah, because at Gen Con, just for everybody, we played like a demo copy. We had, you know, it was a full color board with there's a countdown clock because you're counting down to the end of the universe, and we had minis and cards and the whole deal. So where do you get all that kind of stuff when you're just needing to put together, you know, something for a few people to play?
Part of it is I just personally can't enjoy a highly thematic game like this unless it looks good. So frankly, the answer is FedEx Office. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I would have a new idea for a card, and I couldn't just print it out on paper and then sleeve it in like a Magic the Gathering, you know, sleeve. I really had to just go to FedEx and hand them like a USB drive with like all of my files on it and have them print it out real nice. So we made a bunch of prototypes, you know, on cardboard and foam core. And then when we decided to make miniatures for the game, we used a company called Sculptio, and they're a French-based company where you submit your 3D files, and then they tell you it's going to be like hundreds and hundreds of dollars, but then you get 3D printed miniatures in the mail, and they're paintable and everything, and so you can actually make a fairly great-looking prototype, but it costs hundreds of dollars if you include the cost of the miniatures. But it's worth it because then you can use that prototype to convince reviewers to review your game and make a video that features the miniatures. And it sort of shows that you're not just pretending, that you know, you're taking this very seriously and you're putting your money and your time where your mouth is.
Yeah, I wanted to say, I mean, because I've looked through the prototype piece, you know, the demo game that we played on, it was, you know, it was dinged up a little bit. It had seen use, but it was really nice. I mean, it was full color and the whole deal, good, you know, cardstock, the whole thing. The counter, as I recall, was really dinged up. And you even commented on that because, well, you know, it's something that everybody handles every turn of the game. But I'm looking at the stuff on the website for the Kickstarter, and wow, you know, that's some really slick looking stuff. Really,
thank you.
Really great production quality. How many artists worked on that?
So there's several artists. There's the primary artist is William Toombs. He's a British writer and scholar, and he directs children's theater and all sorts of things. And he designed the aliens. He designs them out of clay and then photographs the clay, and then he composites all the different photographs together. So he'll design an arm and light it and then photograph it and then put the arm on the body in Photoshop, and then he'll photograph like the, you know, like the brains and stuff.
Wow. That Ray was just kind of looking at me like, really? Really? Is this,
wow,
like, is this what, wow, yeah, geez.
Yeah, okay. So that's how he does the aliens.
All right, no joke, everybody. This there's some real work that went into this, and kudos to you and all the guys and gals, if there are any as well. Yeah, you put your blood, sweat, and tears into this thing.
Yeah, it's my life.
We were talking about that outside of the record button a little bit, where basically he has everything he needs to do to feed himself and bathe himself and clothe himself, and then this game. That's pretty
well,
much.
I never said anything about bathing or clothing myself. You want to know what I'm wearing right now?
Sure,
not
why
a lot,
not,
my friend? Not a lot. I live in Los Angeles, and it's sunny and gorgeous.
But a little bit, just to describe it for the people too. They can pick up on it if they go to the Kickstarter website. But you know, the basics of it is of the game was that you're playing this alien. Every alien has some unique abilities, and you fly around to different planets, and on different planets you start with some equipment, and some of it starts on planets. You go around, you find this and that. You can attack the other players to get their stuff. There's ultimately one thing, the Ovoid, that everybody wants. That's the thing that's going to save you when the universe collapses.
And thank you for not calling that unobtainium.
Right. So the Ovoid is the new universe in miniature. And so when it hatches like out of an egg. And so you're going to want to have that because you'll imprint onto it. And then the next universe you'll be the master of, which is great because everyone wants to be the master of the universe. But
especially He-Man.
Especially He-Man and She-Ra, of course.
All right, there we go.
The mistress of the universe, of course.
Ooh. That sounds like she's just, you know, just gold digging for the universe. But
cue the porno music.
No.
We don't.
But yeah, so you want the Ovoid very badly. That's the win.
You were on it. You're right. So it's sort of like a deck building game, but instead of building a deck that you're gonna use, you're sort of moving around from planet to planet, essentially building a small deck of cards on each planet. And when you go back to a planet, if no one else has been there, then it's going to be the way you left it. But someone else could land there and take some of the cards and leave other cards, and their trash might be your treasure, because all the cards are good in the game, but it might be situationally good. So if you know that I have a particular blaster and you want to disable my blaster, you might have to go back to a planet that you were at a little while ago and get the counter for it. And if I don't know you have the counter, but you know that I have the blaster, then you sort of have an extra piece of knowledge that will help you win in the next combat. So you're constantly adapting to each other, landing on planets, changing out your hand with stuff you left before. You're setting traps and vaults to protect cards that you leave on planets. And those cards are going face up. Normally cards go face down, but certain tactical equipment can be slid into the envelopes. There's envelopes, by the way.
Yes. very each planet. Up.
Yeah, very good mechanic, by the way.
Yeah, whatever equipment is on the planet ends up in an envelope for that planet. And so you don't get to look into there until you land on the planet and get the stuff.
Right. So that was inspired by like ripping open a Magic the Gathering booster pack. It's that the first time you land on a planet, it's that exploration.
Ooh, what's in here? Yeah.
What's in here? Is it going to be something good? It could be the Ovoid. It could be, you know, a bunch of environment gear for aliens that, you know, that are not you. Or it might be just a bunch of random equipment, which is what it usually is, because all the cards are distributed randomly at the beginning. And you're going to start with a bunch of, not necessarily junk, but it's not going to work together very well. And so you're going to have a lot of choices. It's an open world sandbox kind of game where you're going to have a lot of freedom to go left or go right or go forward or go backward. And you can even go forward and backward in time in this game. So.
And the replayability is ridiculous because, like you said, everything starts, you can play different aliens. Everything starts randomly distributed amongst the cards.
Right. Yeah. I did a calculation recently. I've played the game over 1,000 times. Still going. Love it.
And how many times have you lost in a row now?
Yeah. Well, that's embarrassing.
As the designer. Yeah.
We made a video where I admit in the video that I've lost 22 times in a row. And the reason that happened is because I'm constantly trying to break the game by trying new strategies. And every time I play, I try a new strategy and I try to figure out a way that I can game the system, so to speak. And the game, it sort of amazes me. It came out not only better than I thought it ever could, but it keeps basically revealing new mysteries about itself. And just when I think I sort of have figured out, like, okay, this is the best way to play, I might change who I'm playing against. And just the psychological aspect of having a new player that I don't know very well, a new player can often beat me because I'm thinking that they're tricking me or double tricking me or triple tricking me. And
when they're trying to find something.
Right.
It's like, I'm just going from planet to planet to try to find the Ovoid, and you're there thinking, oh, they're mixing around the cards and the envelopes, and they're trying to set traps. And
right, but that's part of the fun.
Yeah, and it's described, how is it described on the website, which I thought was plenty of words, but it gets the point across. A hand management strategy game of spying, hoarding, deceiving, stashing, and sneaking. And that is what it is. I mean, you're doing all sorts of things. It's not just, you know, play the cards in order or just try to attack each other. I mean, you could potentially win the game without ever attacking another character.
Right.
Which is what Bill did in our game.
Yes.
He had the Ovoid in his hand.
And you just avoided.
And he just avoided everybody.
Until the very bitter end.
And when we all went after him, because we figured he's got to have it, because we had all attacked each other and saw each other's hands. And none of us, we all was like, none of us has it. And Bill's just sitting over there.
And he had built up massive defenses.
There's a card in there. What is it? The spores? Something spores?
Right. There's spores.
That
you collect the spores.
There's multiple cards. There's like three or four of them in the deck.
Right. There's three spores. And each spore is worth a combat value in total equal to the number of other spores that you have. So if you have three spores, then each one is worth two. And so you have plus six if you have three spores, which is really powerful.
That's a big number in the game.
Right.
So he managed to get all three of them. By the time we got down to the last couple of rounds, he had the Ovoid and three spores in his hand and like whatever else, like some other little something here and there. And every time somebody would attack him, he'd just go, bam, plus six. And you'd be like, oh, well, no.
Yeah, but like
running back to my planet.
Yeah, one hand he had like plus 11.
Wow.
Yeah, because then there's situational stuff. And yeah, I mean, just we didn't have a chance. And he's in the video, actually. He's raising his hands above his head in triumph.
He squashed us.
That's hilarious. There's something that you'll find as you play the game is when you see what a player is doing or not doing, that will dramatically impact what you are going to do on your turn. So if you have a very specific strategy, okay, I have two spores and I'm going to go for a spore strategy, and I think there's a spore that's on Pendro or maybe Gurriwan, and I'm going to head over there and get the spores. And then you see, you know, for some reason, the spore immunity gets revealed on the other side of the board. Now you're thinking, okay, someone over there has the spore immunity. That's the person I need to fight. And I just landed on this planet with nothing but a poison dart. Maybe I'll just take the poison dart instead and leave the spores so no one else can get them. And then maybe I'll take the poison dart and a couple imps and this blaster, and I'll go after him with these other things. Now he's going to carry the spore immunity, thinking that it's going to deactivate my spores, but I've left my spores behind. He's just filling up his hand with this useless immunity card. So, you know, if you can adapt to each other, that's the strongest way to win. So you got to find that immunity if he's got the spores, and if you can't find the immunity, then you're going to have to figure out a different way to get it from him. And sometimes you can and sometimes you can't, but you'll find, you keep playing the game, you'll get better at it.
Was that scenario you just described, was that one of your 22 in a row losses? Is that how you approached it sometime? And
I should never give advice to anyone on how to win this game.
Just answer the rules questions and move on.
Right. Yeah. Now, I've been winning a lot recently because I've been trying to win.
I watched that video of the playtest with you and Sam, Hallie, and Matt.
Right.
And that was pretty entertaining. One thing, or a few things that I noticed, one was that, now I'm not a guy that plays a lot of these kind of games. I think maybe I've played, what is that zombie one that you have?
Last Night on Earth.
Is that it?
I think you've played that.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the card game. Yeah, that's pretty much it. That's all I played. Played that once. So.
Oh, well, there's Flux. Yeah, that's the card game, Zombie Flux. You haven't played the board game.
Right. Right. No.
Anyway.
So, but having watched that video and checked out all of the stuff on the Kickstarter page, it seems like it's just dead easy. Like, it's not, it seems like when you first look at it, like, it's really complicated, but if you actually watch that game or that video with everyone playing, it seems like, oh, I totally can grasp all of these concepts. And it's like, it's a lot of cards and there's a lot of different weapons
stuff
and
to keep track of.
Yeah. And,
but the basics game, of the rule,
the basics of the game and the mechanics are actually pretty simple, I think, and easy, but not simple, but easy to grasp a hold of. So I can see how it's very easy to, once you get into it for a few minutes, you can concentrate on the psychological stuff about playing against the other players.
Yeah, and that's what happened when it was at Gen Con, it was a 2-hour playtesting slot. And, you know, they spent 15 minutes describing the game, kind of getting us all up to speed. And then we talked about it a little bit afterwards. The game only lasted an hour and 20, maybe.
Yeah. That's the other thing.
And that was with all brand new players who grasped, you know, so boom, we grasped it all really quickly.
That's the other thing I really like. And one of our other regular guests, Matthew, has this thing where he talks about, and this is specifically to like work meetings. He said anything that lasts longer than 45 minutes, you better, you know. It, whatever you want him to know, you better talk about in the first 45 minutes, because after that he checks out.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of that way with games and gaming, which is why I don't do a lot of D&D anymore, because I just can't handle 3-4 hours at a time. but I'll take Matthew's rule of 45 minutes and double it to say 90 minutes for a game. And this game is what, 60 to 90 minutes max.
Right. Yeah.
And that's right in my wheelhouse. So I'm looking forward to playing this once Craig gets a hold of his set.
Yes, I backed it from the airport on the day you started the Kickstarter.
Oh, thank you.
I was sitting at the airport and I saw the little notification came up. I was like, well, my flight's delayed, so this will kill 3 minutes. I'll go ahead and buy my copy of the board game.
And how'd that work out for you?
It worked out nicely. I got my copy ordered. I'm all ready to go. I'm just waiting for Joey and the other people over there to basically kill themselves over the course of the next several months. And provide me with my game. I'm looking forward to it.
You're lucky that we have done the playtest stuff. So, and we've got most of the art. So it's just a matter of getting into a queue at the manufacturer, and then, you know, I would love to get it out by Gen Con. That would be my goal, but you never really know how it's going to work with manufacturing delays and things like that.
Yeah. So how many total game boxes do you have ordered so far?
We see that
there's 200 and something backers.
So a bunch of them have ordered multiple copies, plus there's retail stores. I was not expecting so many retail stores to get involved, because you'd think that you are competing with other games that they're trying to sell in their store. So why would they buy from Kickstarter? But the truth is, retailers have been awesome. So we've sold or pre-sold something like 800 or 900 copies probably so far. And I have no doubt that we're going to have to order probably 2,500 copies of the game minimum, based on the where we're at in the campaign and where we're going. I think we're gonna have to order a lot.
Congratulations, sir.
Thank you.
And tell everybody else the same thing, all the other people who are involved. It's quite the impressive little feat that you've promised to pull off.
That I promised to pull off.
I have confidence.
It's my life, and I've now committed to it to a degree that there's sort of no going back at this point. When you tell all your friends and all your family and all the random strangers you know and everyone you've ever met in your entire life, I am making this board game. And then a bunch of money comes in and a bunch of people have very specific requests. So can you send this copy to Malaysia and this copy to London? And you're kind of pot committed at this point. And if you don't succeed, then you're gonna have to really explain yourself.
Yeah, you got a lot of explaining to do.
Right.
got a lot of apology letters to write.
The board game industry has been pretty amazing about being reliable about delivering games. And I think most backers on Kickstarter are pretty knowledgeable about, or they're discerning as to which projects to back and which ones are kind of maybe not trustworthy. And so there's been very few projects that haven't really worked out. And so that's been a good thing for the industry.
Any final thoughts, Ray?
Yes. So this is for all of the Nerdburger listeners out there.
All nine of them.
Yes. So I love board games. First of all, so
yeah,
your
basement there doesn't
yeah.
tell me that. There's board games everywhere.
But in particular,
everywhere.
Do we need him to give us a picture? Put it next to the picture of your
five or six
your
photos.
Shelves.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, panoramic.
There you go.
Yeah. So, and in particular, I love geek board games. You know, sci-fi, fantasy, and when Craig convinced me to go in and do the play testing. At Gen Con, because there's a big playtesting room at Gen Con, and you go in, you pick a game, and
well, we got randomly assigned. We didn't even pick. We just said, "Yeah, we just want to play something."
Yeah, well, I think the one guy that he said, you know, we've got like one or two these two things that are open, and we kind of went for.
It was like two options, and one sounded okay. We was like, well, we'll try it off the board game. I don't remember what the other one was.
Yeah, I think it was like, you know, it was like, you want fantasy or you want sci-fi? We all looked around. Right. Let's go sci-fi. We've been doing a lot of D&D gaming at Gen Con, so let's go sci-fi. So. I walked away from this board game thinking that this was the most fun I had ever had playing a board game.
So there you go.
Wow.
Wow.
You can put that on the box.
I'm writing that down right now.
Some guy in Atlanta says, a Ray from Atlanta, I guess we go that far.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to say about that. Especially considering it sounded the way you described the game, it sounds like a couple of you were flailing the whole time. But,
no, but I mean, it was still fun. We didn't realize how screwed we were.
Oh yeah,
until
killed.
The end.
Yeah, I got wiped.
When Bill informed us that, I've had the Ovoid since the opening hand, and he's just been slowly building up his little spore army. And staying out of the way.
This was the most fun I've ever had losing a game.
Exactly. This was the most fun I ever had, spending an hour wandering around a board looking for something, not finding it,
and then getting my ass kicked.
handed to me in the last 15 minutes.
Yeah, it's
says the guy who lost 22 times in a row.
I lost one time in a row.
That's the good thing about the open world kind of sandbox games. You find a way to make the game fun. You know, I read an article about Grand Theft Auto Vice City when it first came out, where one of the playtesters had like a 9-year-old daughter who discovered the game while he was at work, and he came home and freaked out because she was playing this thing. Oh, and he's like, what have you been doing for the last 3 hours? She said, well, I've been driving this moped, and I've been paying attention to all the traffic signals, and you'll be so proud of me, Dad. And she had no idea that you could murder and pillage and meet prostitutes. And
she was just being a good driver.
You make your own fun in games like this. And, you know, if making a big epic base full of like tons of awesome weapons and you feel invincible, if that's what it takes to have fun, then do that. If looking for the ovoid is giving you some headaches, just wait for the final turn and try to build up an arsenal. But if somebody sees that you're just hanging out building up an arsenal, they're gonna try to lay some gorilla drop capsules on you and steal some of your stuff so that you can't build up an arsenal. So whatever you decide to do with your time playing the game, you will have fun, and you'll probably win unless somebody notices what you're doing and tries to adapt to that strategy.
All right, so there's some more advice from the guy who lost 22 times in a row.
Yeah, I've been
winning a lot lately.
But has been winning lately, that's true.
I'm on a winning streak, and excellent. I've been winning pretty much nonstop for the past game.
Well, there you go, everybody. Go back, Chaosmos. If you don't, you're not a true Nerdburger fan. Drop the mic. Walk off the stage. Yeah, exactly. And keeping in with our space theme today.
Space!
Take it away, Ray. What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I watch a lot of like you know, History Channel and
dork.
Science Channel and
dork.
And my job allows some downtime, so I tend to browse the interwebs quite a bit, and I've been paying attention to the Kepler mission, which is looking for exoplanets. So exoplanets being planets of other star systems, for those that don't know,
much like in Chaosmos.
Yes,
correct.
So I've been very excited because there's been just 2009 Kepler was launched, and there's been a lot of advances in planetary discoveries, up to the point where we now think that there is a planet orbiting every star system. Planet or planets orbiting every star system.
Hmm.
That's a lot of planets.
Is there a trillion? A trillion stars? You'll have to listen to the earlier part of the episode to get that joke.
Maybe okay, a Brazilian.
Right. How many?
A Brazilian?
Brazilian?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Wow, I could go all kinds of directions with that, but
back to the science.
Back to the science. Yes. Okay. So the hard science is we've got a lot of planets. Now, you know, if Carl Sagan were here, you know, he might, you know, billions and billions of stars. If for those of you remember the Carl Sagan mm-hmm. show, yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. So statistically, life on other planets, it seems like there'd be a pretty high percent, especially when now they're looking at 1 in 5 being in the Goldilocks zone.
Ah.
Or the habitable zone. Okay.
Not too hot, not too cold.
Yes.
Wow, that's almost 20%.
And very delicious.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I happened to catch a show on Nova the other day, because you know, Goldilocks zone is pretty self explanatory, not too hot, not too cold. But well, there's a little bit more science behind that, in that what we've discovered on Earth is that every creature on Earth requires liquid water to survive.
Sure.
All right. So the assumption is that in order for other creatures out in the universe that are going to be somewhat similar to us or similar to life on
Earth. Similar to life on Earth. Could right. be as simple as bacteria.
Right. But it's all going to require water to survive. So the Goldilocks zone is in that zone where if a planet's too close to its sun, water is going to boil,
heat evaporate.
If it's too far away from the sun, it's going to freeze, right? So you're going to have...
And I don't want to get my, what is it, 8 glasses a day by like sucking on ice cubes, so...
No Mars for you.
So, right, yeah. So 20% of the planets out there, statistically speaking, are in that somewhere in that habitable zone.
Scientists think. At this
right.
point, sure.
Right. Now see, like when I was going through high school, you know, we were always told that our sun was an average sun. Well, now it's turning out that our sun is not an average sun. Most of the suns out in the universe are red dwarfs. Which are, you know, like...
Teeny tiny.
Yeah, you take a basketball and then you put a pea next to it, and that pea is the red dwarf. The basketball is our sun. They're tiny.
What kind of sun is our sun?
It's a yellow sun.
It's just a yellow sun?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. So here's one of the really cool things. Kepler...
His name is Saul.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
On the third day that Kepler was out looking for exoplanets, it found a planet. Now, it took them another 10 months before they could double-check that information, and another 10 months after that before they could really be sure that this was an actual planet. The reason being is because the planet that they discovered was around a yellow sun similar to ours. The planet was in the habitable zone, but it was really big. Not as big as Jupiter and Saturn, but like 8 times the size of Earth. And since then, now they believe that the entire thing is covered in water.
Wow. Ooh.
It's a water world.
That's a lot of water.
All right, Kevin Costner, get on this.
Yeah.
Get in a spaceship. You and Dennis Hopper.
So a lot of water. So that, so that's that.
Okay,
was,
so you got the water. Good. Yep.
It goes around its sun in what would be equivalent to our 10 months.
Oh, it's almost a year.
Almost a year, yep. Very likely. I mean, there's a lot of water potential for... Now, the only problem is any land or any solid rock substance is buried so far deep inside that planet that imagine the pressure that would be involved to get to what would be the seafloor.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So any life that evolved there would have to be, you know, it's going to be plankton, maybe some fish type creature. Who knows?
Well, it'll be stuff like, you know, sea worms.
Yeah.
It'll be, you know, at least at the beginning.
Right, right. But
all the little wormy things and all the little mollusky things. And
but maybe, you know, you might have some type
of... Might be something out there.
Yeah, there might be something out there. So that I thought that was really kind of neat.
So how close is this planet? How far away is this solar system?
Good question. 600 light years.
That's quite a trek just to go fishing.
Yeah. Now, closer to us, in our own backyard, they have found two planets, Tau Ceti A and B, I think. But they've named them Tau Ceti, and then of course they go through with their planets are then, if there's multiple planets, they're labeled A, B, C, D,
right.
Et cetera. Right. Okay. So you've got one of the Tau Cetis is in the habitable zone, but it's on the inside of that habitable zone, so it's kind of warm.
Sure.
So they think, you know, it's possible, but they're roughly Earth-sized planets. The other planet in the Tau Ceti zone, or in the habitable zone of Tau Ceti, is on the outside. So might be too cold, not quite sure. Those planets are about 12 light years away, 11 and a half.
Oh, so a stone's throw.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to get my backpack. And we'll
walking stick, canteen.
So,
well, in astronomical terms,
couple of power bars.
That's next door.
Yes, exactly, exactly. But when you think about that, though, still, at the speed of what Voyager was traveling through our solar system, it would still take Voyager like 76,000 years to get. To get to the closest solar system, which is like 5 light years away, right? So, you know, what, 152,000 years?
Too far.
Yeah.
We need faster than light travel.
We need something different, yeah.
Yes, we need something different. Right. So, but in discovering all this, it started making me think, you know, wow, we could be in our lifetimes, we might discover that there's life on other planets.
Sure. It's possible.
Could happen.
I don't know the mysteries of the universe. Do you, Mike?
No.
Joey?
I had to create a fake mystery of the universe to get through the fact that I don't understand the real mystery.
Excellent. So that's a no.
Right.
Yeah, so hey.
The no's have it.
Who knows? That'd be something.
We knows.
Yes, that'd be something. That'd be one of those where were you when?
Yeah.
When they make the announcement that, you know, scientists have definitively proven that there's life in, you know, such and such a place, not on this planet.
Not on this planet.
Well, you should. I mean, are you talking intelligent life? Because I think it's still possible that they'll come up with something about Mars. I think that would be really, really fun.
I think so too. I think they'll find like some type of bacteria on Mars or something. I think sooner or later they will find something on Mars. But yeah, I'm actually thinking along the lines of intelligent life. Like, you know, Kepler's going to zero in on a planet, and
somebody's going to be looking back.
Yeah, you know, they're going to go, well, there's an awful lot of light coming off that planet. Mm-hmm. Wait, that's artificial light. You know, and now keep in mind, let's say that planet is 20 light years away when they discover it, right? Well, that means again, the light traveling from that planet is going to be
20 years old.
So, you know, if they had more catastrophes in their history than we did, they might be further behind in us technologically speaking. They might be, you know, living in a gas age still or something, you know, Victorian gaslight lamps or something. But if they haven't had as many catastrophes as us, natural catastrophes and man-made catastrophes.
Middle Ages.
Yeah, right, right. They
Dark Ages.
They could be millions of years ahead of us. Right? First really big extinction.
Well, regardless of catastrophes, if the universe is as old as people think maybe it is, and by people I mean scientists, well, just to be clear on that, if we think it's billions of years old, then, you know, they don't, even with a bunch of catastrophes, they could still be millions and millions of years.
That's right.
Years ahead of us.
They could. So that leads me to my next question, which is now we're going to kind of diverge from hard science into, like, I've known Craig for quite a while. This topic just has never come up.
Mushy science.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
A little squishy.
Some of my, yes, a little squishy.
Gives under your feet.
Oh.
Ghostbuster science.
There you go.
ETs, what do you think? Do you think we've been visited in the past? Do you think we're being visited now? And this tying in with given the fact that we now know that, or we now suspect that, you know,
life could be abundant in the universe.
Yes.
And intelligent life.
Yes.
At that. There's an awful lot of weird crap that people report and talk about. And
well,
I'd hesitate to say no.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's intelligent life out there. I wouldn't be surprised, to be honest, if we had been visited. Actually, I'd be a little surprised because the cynic in me says that any race that is significantly advanced to the point that they have faster than light travel and can actually get here and remain hidden from our technology, and more importantly, have faster than light travel, probably has progressed in a number of other things. And if they come here with any sort of hostile intentions, we're fucked.
Oh, yeah.
It's done.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
All the alien invasion movies where the aliens come in and the humans fight back, no.
Yeah.
No.
Not going to happen.
Never. They will come in and go, blip, and that's it.
Everyone's gonna call Will Smith and be like, "Dude, you get now.
Get
Jeff Goldblum and his power book
and his DOS virus."
Yeah, and they're gonna be like, "I'm just an actor."
Well, in the War of the Worlds, I can't remember the recent movie, but in the story, the original story, humans can't fight back. We're helpless. And then bacteria kills the aliens. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yep.
Because those aliens never bothered to take an air sample.
Right.
You know,
well,
gaping plot hole, yeah, but, you know, it is what it is.
They didn't have
trouble. Well, it's better than we take them down with, like, you know, cannons or whatever happens in the...
Pew, pew, pew.
What's the battleship movie?
Oh, yeah. What was it?
Well, there was Battlefield Los Angeles or something like that.
Los Angeles. I missed that one.
Oh, my God.
Here, well, here come the aliens.
Okay. Highly entertaining.
Problem solved.
Yes. Yeah. Well, then there was Battlefield Earth.
Which oh, was well, the, that's the whole... that's
Yeah, the whole Scientology.
Oh.
Hey, I live in Hollywood. You wouldn't believe what it's like out here. they walk amongst us, but they are not us.
Joey,
are we talking about aliens or Scientologists?
Oh no, Scientologists.
Okay. Are you a Scientologist?
No, I'm not a Scientologist.
But yeah, that's my, you know, if they've been here, okay, I wouldn't put it past, you know, the realm of possibility, but I also think that I kind of hope that faster than light travel never actually happens. I'd be fine with just discovering that they're out there. It's like, hey, how's it going? You're right there. We're here. Never will our paths meet, because if your path can get here faster than our path can get there, then we're all done.
Yeah. Well, then there's the opposite end of the spectrum, which is, you know, maybe in a couple hundred years, we've discovered that we can travel to maybe, you know, near light speed. And we go off and discover a world, and then you have Avatar. You know, because all the other races out there are more primitive than us. You know?
Yeah, but then we'll just do what, you know, what the people did in Avatar, or what I'm afraid the aliens will come here to do. We'll just show up somewhere and go, squash, and that'll be it for them.
They'll show up, and
once again, we'll be the, instead of being the a-holes of North America or of the Earth, we'll be the a-holes of the galaxy. These people just show up and kill everybody, take their stuff.
South America, too.
Yeah. Well, everywhere. Unless they're super-duper enlightened aliens and they're here to enlighten us or warn us of something.
Yeah, so that leads me into the really mushy, not science at all. So I have an acquaintance who is a student and scholar of Mayan history.
Alrighty.
Okay. And he was very outspoken against the whole, 2012 doomsday end of the, you know, he's like, no, that's not how the, you know, the Mayans didn't really believe that.
The calendar just doesn't work like that.
Yeah. Well, it was just, you know, it was all North American hype and people trying to cap, you know, they were trying to make a name for themselves when they were presenting the whole doomsday scenario based on but
fear sells a lot of books.
It does. He has some very interesting ideas about alien visitation. So let me, for your entertainment purposes,
okay,
let me present to you. All right. Apparently, there are three alien races that have visited the Earth and continue to visit the Earth.
Ooh, can I guess which?
Sure, please.
The Greys?
Yes.
Reptilians?
Yes.
And the blondes, the tall ones?
The Norse giants?
Yes.
Yes.
That's my alien. That's just irritating. But mine was a good
and
rendition
wasn't.
Of an alien flying saucer landing. Okay, so there's the Greys. Sure, those are the space probers, the ones that take you away from here in between episode recordings, Mike.
They're clones, and the reason
they're clones of each other.
Yes, and the reason they're abducting us is because they're looking for new genetic material to add into their. Into their genome.
Sexy.
Because they've been Xeroxed one too many times and
apparently
now they're dying.
Resistance apparently. Is futile. We will add your biological distinctiveness to our own.
Then we have the reptilians, which now he believes the reptilians, they're shapeshifters, by the way.
Oh, awesome. Well, so they're not actually reptilians.
Well, yes. No, they are reptilians, but that's their natural state.
You almost never see them that way.
Gotcha. Right, because they can shapeshift into us.
Right, and walk among us.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, the reptilians...
I don't know what you're talking about.
Apparently,
never heard of these.
Yeah.
What you talking about? We got to wrap this up pretty soon.
I think I just saw his tongue flip.
I saw the same thing.
All right, so speeding right along. So, yes, the reptilians were not... They were here at the same time that another cat-like race was apparently walking among us, who were also meow. Shapeshifters.
Meow.
But supposedly...
Sorry.
Supposedly the reptilians wiped out the cat-like race or drove them away from us. And then
are they cold-blooded?
I don't know.
I don't know.
A skink got into our house, you know, my cat was going to
tear that thing to shreds. So yeah. I think that the cat-like race would have wiped the reptilians out. But anyway.
Yeah, who knows?
Well, the reptilians wiped the cat people out when they were just, like, lying in the window. When it was sunny. Just waited for the cat people to let their guard down.
Yes, because the cat people have to sleep 20 hours a day.
And that was their downfall?
That was their downfall.
Okay, yes. And?
So, but there have been wars fought in our over our Earth. Like, apparently at one point in time, this goes being to ties into some Indian dot, not feather, Indian texts.
That's okay.
where there were three great cities that floated in the sky over the Earth, and those three great cities went to war, and they fought amongst themselves, and then they drove themselves off, and why
were they floating in the sky?
Because they were actually spaceships.
Also, why didn't Zeus put a stop to this? Where the hell was Odin when all of this was going down?
Because they were one of the three great cities, and they were up in the you know, north area, kind of doing their own thing. And
okay, but what about Quetzalcoatl? Where was Quetzalcoatl when all of this was going on?
Well, see, he's supposedly tied in with the reptilians.
You got an answer for everything over there. All right.
He was part of the reptilian race that were warring against one of the other races. Okay. That was here. So the Greys.
What is your acquaintance's source and all this stuff?
I'm scared to ask. So apparently he knows this woman who is able to communicate with alien races through some mental telepathy.
And there you have it.
Yes. So,
what about the...
Again, like I said, for entertainment purposes only.
Sure.
The Norse blonde people?
Yeah, they were the Nordic gods.
Odin, okay.
Odin and Thor and Frey and Freya. And yeah, they were the ones that taught the Norsemen how to raid, pillage, plunder for whatever they wanted, because that's what they were, was raiders, pillagers, and plunderers.
Where does Atlantis figure into all of this?
I don't know.
Ah, hole in the theory. Got to have a whole cohesive theory of otherworlders, maybe the Atlanteans.
So the evidence that there's aliens is that the humans could not have figured out how to raid and pillage and plunder on their own.
Yeah, Joey, thank you. thank you. I'm very confident that mankind can figure out how to do all of the horrible things and also all of the good things that we have done in our, without being told how to do it. We can figure all that stuff out. We're smart enough and at the same time dumb enough.
And to most do all importantly, of those things. As our board game creator would testify, we have imagination.
Yes, we have the ability to think laterally as well as linearly.
Oh, I already have an idea
and extrapolate for things.
A board game. Imagine a board game, and there's three cities, right? And you're going to play one of three alien races, and you're each going to have your own unique variable player power. I'm working on this now.
All right, get on that.
I can hear him typing away.
Are you going to come up with a complete version of the game and then trash it because it doesn't play well, and then redesign it in a McDonald's parking lot at 2 a.m?
How do you know all about that?
Because you told us about that at Gen Con.
I recounted
the story on the podcast.
Yeah, all my good ideas come out when I'm in a McDonald's parking lot at 2 a.m. Yeah.
All righty. Anything else, Ray? Or
no,
have you exhausted your thoughts on that?
Well, no. I could speak for days on any one of these three topics of exoplanets or aliens or prehistoric visitation, chariots of the gods type stuff. But yeah, I mean, you know, at the risk of turning this into a podcast marathon.
Yeah.
Supersizing your nerd burger.
Yes.
Yeah, we're doing that today, I think. All right, everybody. Ray, thank you for coming on board.
Thank you. I apologize I was late.
Fired. Joey, thank you for getting up bright and early to join
us. Thank you.
And thank you for designing a fun board game.
Thank you. Yes. Like, should I pimp my board game before I sign off?
Go for it. And we'll link to it and all that fun stuff too.
Right. So the game is Chaosmos, and it's spelled like chaos and cosmos mixed together. And it's on Kickstarter now, and you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/mirrorboxgames.
All right. Mike, where can they find us?
They can find us at nerdburgershow.com, at nerdburgershow on the Twitters and Facebook, and email us, nerdburgershow@gmail.com.
On the next episode of Nerdburger, Mike searches for the Ovoid, while Craig builds his Spore army, and we don't even have the board game here yet. So
I found the Ovoid along with 11 others in the fridge.
Oh. Jeez. Are there any spores?
On the cheese.
There you go. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.